Reza Aslan is with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell, you want to start with evolution or reformation?
Well, reformation, actually, because it goes to what you were just saying, that, you know, the commonality, what we share, most of us in this country, I'm sure, and in the West, think of reformation in terms of the Protestant mm-hmm. Reformation in the, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 1900s, continuing to today in some ways. But to apply that and to apply it today to Islam is an interesting notion, and one, frankly, I hadn't heard a great deal about.
Well, it's interesting because you're right. It is nearly impossible, I think, to strip that term Reformation of its European and Christian connotations.
And it's very much European in that sense.
Very much European, yes. But what I'm trying to do as a scholar of comparative religions is to explain to an audience, and this takes us right back to the evolution term, that these are conflicts, these are evolutionary changes that occur in all great religious traditions. There is nothing unique about what happened in 16th century Germany with Christianity. This fundamental conflict over who has the authority to define faith, the institutions or the individual, is one that one finds throughout the history of religions. Certainly we can talk about, for instance, Judaism's Reformation is one that we're, I think, most familiar with after Christians' Reformation, because it occurred in first century Palestine. And we know, of course, the greatest of those, the Jewish reformers, the one that we remember most clearly is Jesus Christ, whose ultimate message was that authority rests in the hands of the individuals, not in the hands of the institutions, in his case, the Pharisees, the Sadducees.
So that's again, not the way most people think about Reformation.
No, it is not. It is not.
But this is a more global view.
It is a much more universal view, and that's what I'm trying to remind an audience about. That same process has been occurring in Islam for a good century or so, and has a lot to do with some of the geopolitical rifts that took place in the wake of colonialism, which was a devastating and profoundly influential experience in the Muslim world. We're talking about an era in which 90% of the world's Muslims lived under colonial rule. That's amazing. It's an incredible thing to think about. And it created a very lasting schism in the Muslim world, one that we are still seeing take place, not just in the discussion over the creation of an Islamic polity or an Islamic democracy, but also in the way that we're seeing this rift between who has the authority to define what Islam means for the modern world.
I was really quite surprised. There were many things I did not know as I read No God But God, but what surprised me most was this impact of colonialism, because I kept thinking I'm going to be learning about the Prophet Muhammad. I'm going to have a kind of arcane, esoteric mm-hmm. information about a religion with which I should be more familiar. And yet it's colonialism that is the big elephant in the room and that continues. And we don't talk about that, particularly in America. We don't talk about particularly English Great Britain's colonialism, but again, these questions of Reformation. What's the 10% that wasn't colonial, rather than what are the 90% that was? Who escaped it?
Well, there were parts of sub-Saharan Africa that were just not interesting to the colonialists, and there were parts of East Asia that were not interesting to the colonialists. I think this is what's really fascinating. You're absolutely right, Paula. You know, in this country, colonialism is something we read about in history books.
And when we do it, we don't use its name.
No, and you know, it's just so far beyond our experience, our historical experience. And we tend to forget that this was...
Except we were one.
Well, exactly. We were ourselves colonized. You're absolutely correct.
Well, and we still engage in it, at least in the economic.
Well, and it
you're
hasn't
absolutely died
right.
out.
That's sort of the main question that is being bandied about a lot, is that the physical act of colonialism has been replaced by economic and cultural colonialism. And in that case, it is the United States that is leading the way. But, you know, this was an era that only ended about 50 years ago. It's still very much in the consciousness of the Muslim world, and anything that smacks of the colonialist endeavor, whether it's cultural colonialism or economic colonialism or military colonialism, really, I think, comes across in a very sensitive way in the Muslim world.
Well, 50 years, your grandparents are still alive.
Oh, absolutely.
I want to go back to this Reformation, because I'm increasingly convinced that modern history is a harmonic of history, that there are these longer waves, and there's this, what you describe, the Jewish Reformation and the Protestant Reformation, and now the Islamic Reformation. And the timing is interesting, because it seems to be a phase, though the times are certainly not precise, but there seems to be a phase that these religions go through, that they start with a revolutionary perspective.
You could say that of the Zoroastrians as well.
Well, many religions, mm-hmm. Buddhism, same thing, something that an individual looks around and discerns grave injustices, however those are described in the society of which he, and it's all he in this context, of which he's a part, and then something happens, and then something happens, and then way down the road, centuries later, we have this thing called a Reformation.
Mm-hmm. Or a reaction?
Well, I don't know. That's why you're here.
Bill, you bring up a really good point, and that is that we have a tendency to think of our prophets as inventors of religions, which is absurd. Prophets don't invent religions. It's the furthest thing from their minds. Jesus didn't invent Christianity. Moses didn't invent Judaism. Muhammad didn't invent Islam by his own admission. He was not preaching a new religion. The Buddha did not invent Buddhism. Our prophets are, above all else, reformers. Their job is to take the spiritual, the cultural, even sometimes the political milieu in which they live, and to reform it, to create a new set of symbols.
Reform it.
Exactly, exactly. Literally reform it, refashion it, reshape it, provide a whole new set of symbols with which humanity is to understand, their relationship to God. And it is, of course, the prophet's successors who then take those words, take those deeds, and put them together into some unified system of beliefs and practices and call it a religion. And it is that creation of institution that almost by definition begins to collapse in on itself as the institution becomes inevitably more important than the faith itself, than the words and the deeds of the prophet himself. And then you have that fracture. So you're right. It is a common part of the evolutionary process of religious traditions.
Well, and the reforming is in each case, I think, and maybe this is phase two or phase three, is a reaction to clerical power, to the accretion of power within those institutions, and those institutions inevitably become that against which the prophet was reacting.
And that is always the argument of reformers, isn't it? This isn't what it was meant to be.
That's not like the good old days.
Not like the good old days, exactly.
This will be very unsettling to many folks who say, but my religion's the only religion, and these other ones just don't apply to me. And yet these commonalities can be found among all the people who say, no God but God, my God.
Mm-hmm. I begin the book by talking, and I begin all of my courses by with this too, by explaining to an audience the difference between religion and faith. Now that is something that you would think is just would be naturally understood by people, but it is not. It's important to recognize that religion is not faith. I call religion the story of faith, the language with which faith, which is almost by definition inexpressible, is expressed. Now, the problem comes when that separation is misunderstood and one's religion becomes one's faith. When religion is meant to be essentially a means to an end, and suddenly religion becomes the end in and of itself. And that's when you get these irreconcilable absolutisms in some way, that this isn't about a larger issue of faith or God. This is about Christianity. This is about Islam. This is about Judaism. This is about Buddhism. And this set of truths that I have are the only truths, and forget about the fact that they're meant to point me towards the truth. They are themselves truth. And that's where you get these clashes of monotheism, as I referred to about what's going on in some parts of the world today.
And it is from that that those who are committed to the fundamentals of that religion, that is to say, fundamentalists, arise.
Very much so, yes, as a reaction to that.
You do a wonderful thing early on in this book. Most of the translations in this are your translations, which you suggest your
of the Quran.
Yes. Your Arabic is much better than mine, which is to say it exists. This is an analogical argument. But you translate one passage in what I have to believe is accurately in two radically different ways. If one bases one's religion on exegesis of the text, mm-hmm. this exercise is a stunning exercise in the dangers of getting too committed to the words themselves.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, what you're talking about is a particular chapter, chapter 4 of the Quran.
I'm going to interrupt so that I don't have to interrupt the Quran. Please. Reza Aslan is our guest. I'll make this quick. We'll be back in a moment.